Well, good morning, everyone. It's good to be with you. Before we jump into the topic of our conversation this morning, let me just open in a word of prayer. Let's pray. Heavenly God and Father, we come to you this morning. We're thankful that we can gather in this place to talk about something that's really important to our hearts, ministry with and to emerging adults and youth. And Lord, as we start diving into this this research from Rick Heemstra, Lord, we just pray that you open our hearts and our minds to hear the words clearly, to wrestle with them, Lord, and to learn a new thing. And we pray this all in the powerful name of Jesus, your Son, and all God's people say together, amen. We are really grateful that you're all here. Thank you for coming. just a little bit of clarity. We just came from Edmonton, Alberta, 2 days ago, or yesterday, sorry. And Wednesday, we did a presentation like this at King's University. And we were braving, what was it, minus 35 degree temperatures. And so to come here feels like we've entered into a significantly warmer climate. So thank you for bringing us to this place. Now, you've all had to brave some weather this morning that probably isn't normal for you. So thank you for doing that and making the time to come here. We're just really grateful that you did. You know, it was interesting because I'm not from BC, but I do recognize a number of faces. Really good to see some of you, all of you. But the ones who are familiar, it's good to reconnect again. I want to make a specific connection to a couple faces that are new to maybe some of you as well. One is a person I work with in Grand Rapids. I don't come from Grand Rapids, I come from Alberta, but Chris Schoon is the director of Faith Formation Ministries. He is stationed in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and he came out just for this event to be with you all and to be with me. And the second person, also from Grand Rapids, is Rick Zomer from Youth Unlimited. He's the executive director of Youth Unlimited. Just to be clear, not the Youth for Christ Youth Unlimited, but the Youth Unlimited that has been connected to the denomination for over 100 years. What I mean by that is Dynamic Youth Ministries, GEMS Cadets, Youth Unlimited. So just to be clear on that. Some logistics before we begin. Liz, are there washrooms around here that people, if they need it? Okay, just out there. Perfect. We will be breaking after a panel discussion right around 10:30. And before we do that, Liz is going to give an announcement. Not yet, but later. I just want to share with why this conversation and why this event came up. So a number of months ago, I was connecting with some people, and we were wondering what would it look like to bring this really important research to you all. And what I mean by that is a conversation about emerging adults in ministry after high school. And so I want to introduce the team that is bringing this to you today. So I want to begin with Kevin Lobert. He's standing in the back there by the sound booth. He's a youth pastor at Emmanuel CRC in Langley, and currently out on a young adults retreat, and some of their young adults are here as well. So thank you for coming. Really appreciate that. He's also a member of the Classes Children and Youth Task Force, correct? Right on. The second person of our team is Kunrad Bugelink. There he is right there. And Kunrad's the Faith Formation Pastor at Abbotsford Christian School, or Director of Faith Formation at Abbotsford Christian School, but also a Faith Formation Pastor at Gateway CRC in Abbotsford. And Classes Youth Ministry Champion for BC Southeast. So he wears a lot of hats. And then Liz Tolkamp in the back there. And she serves the denomination, she is the children's pastor at Willoughby here, as well as regional catalyzer for BC. The whole province, right? The whole province. And then myself, my name is Ron DeVries. I currently serve the denomination as a youth ministry catalyzer. So that's for North America wide. But I also serve as an ambassador for Youth Unlimited, which is part of Dynamic Youth Ministries, which I just shared with you. One of the things we did was prayed earnestly about what would this event look like. And in that time, we decided to reach out to Rick Heemstra. Now, Rick is the Director of Research and Media Relations at the Evangelical Fellowship of Canada. And prior to assuming these roles, he served as the Director of the Center for Research on Canadian Evangelism. Rick speaks on Canadian church and cultural trends, including the new young adult transition research about faith and the crucial year after high school. Rick authored the 2018 Canadian report called Renegotiating Faith. And that was a follow-up to a research paper that came out 2011-2012 called Hemorrhaging Faith, Why and When Canadian Young Adults Are Leaving, Staying, and Returning to the Church. And so Rick lives in Ottawa, and so he flew all the way from Ottawa to Edmonton and here again. And he lives with his wife, Beth, and their children, John, Anna, James, and Peter. And so today, Rick is going to share two pieces of information for us on the Renegotiating Faith Report, and then a brief piece of information regarding where's the CRC voice in this. And so then he'll be joined by a panel of four people who will share their insights into the report and their respective contexts. Join me in welcoming Rick.
Good morning. Thank you for the invitation to come and present on this research. I just want to say, just reiterate what Ron just said, that I am a dad. I have four kids. My oldest is in third year university. My youngest is 12. And so this topic, it's a really important question to look at, but I'm sort of personally invested in this, like you. And so let's talk about this research. In the summer of 2015, I got an email from a man named Anton Lim at Power to Change. And in the 2011 Hemorrhaging Faith Research, not the Renegotiating Faith Research that I'm here to talk about, in the 2011 Hemorrhaging Faith Research, it identified major life transitions as exit points from the church for many young adults. And so what Anton wanted to know is what we could do about that, especially because he was interested in getting more young adults to end up in Christian campus ministries like Power to Change. So we thought that that was a good question, but we wanted to broaden it out to include non-students because not everybody goes on to post-secondary education. Although today, 70% of young adults will go on to do some kind of post-secondary education, either university, high school, apprenticeship, or something similar. Then we broadened our research out to include all major Christian traditions, so Catholics, mainline Protestants, Orthodox Christians, and evangelicals. And then what we did is we formed a research partnership, because at the Evangelical Fellowship of Canada, we like to work collaboratively, and we find that research that arises out of our constituents' needs and questions done in partnership with them is the very best kind. And so our funding partners, you can see their logos along the bottom of this first slide, were Power to Change Students, InterVarsity Christian Fellowship, Youth for Christ, Truth Matters Ministries, we had a silent funding partner, and then the Evangelical Fellowship of Canada. Our approach was to work in learning cycles, and what we would do is we'd complete one cycle, and then we would use what we had learned from the previous cycles to kind of inform our inquiry in the next. And so we started out with a literature review. That's just learning what other people have already learned about a topic. And then we interviewed 24 ministry experts. And these were youth pastors, young adult pastors, denominational leaders, campus ministry workers, because they have a knowledge and a wisdom that comes from being on the front lines, and we need to learn from that. Then we took what we had learned from the literature review and the ministry expert interviews, and we interviewed 40 young adults. And I'm going to tell you about the population. This is important. These were young adults who had a Christian religious affiliation as a teen and who attended religious services at least monthly at some point while they were teenagers. So this is largely a study about religious persistence. Do they stay in the faith after high school? And so we wanted some minimal bar for religious participation. And so the point of setting this these criteria for being having a Christian religious affiliation and attending at least monthly is that they had some faith to persist in. Then we created two national surveys after we had analyzed those interviews, one for young adults and one for ministry workers. My first presentation is going to concentrate mostly on the young adults. My second presentation is going to look at what we learned from the ministry workers. And we thought it was important to do this because they both have different perspectives on youth ministry. We thought it was important to get both of those. We used Angus Reid Forum for the Young Adult Survey, and we did the Ministry Worker Survey ourselves. We had just under 2,000 responses for the young adults and over 1,500 ministry worker responses. That's enough about the methodology. Let's talk about the research. At the start of this presentation, I want to introduce you to a psychologist named Erik Erikson. And in the late 1960s, Erik Erikson was developing his 8-stage theory of psychosocial development. And it's kind of an odd thing for me as an evangelical to start out a discussion about spiritual matters introducing you to a psychologist. Do I agree with everything Erik Erikson says? No, I don't. But not even psychologists all agree with everything Erik Erikson says. But I do think that when God gives people insight into human development, that we should pay attention and learn and benefit from that insight. And so Erikson developed his 8-stage theory of psychosocial development, and he said that they have to be taken in order. For example, you can't skip from stage four to stage six and get past stage five. And he said that adulthood starts in stage five, which I'm just going to highlight in green here. Adulthood starts in stage five, and it starts when an adult's identity is formed. Now, Erikson said this: becoming an adult happens when an adult's identity is formed and you gain the capacity to make enduring commitments. I'll say that again. Becoming an adult happens when an adult's identity is formed and you gain the capacity to make enduring commitments. So pay attention to these two ideas: identity formation and then the capacity to make enduring commitments. A faith commitment is and a part of your identity, and it is also an enduring commitment. And what Erikson is saying is that young adults actually don't get there until stage five, or they don't get past renegotiating their faith commitments until stage five. And if you look at the slide behind me, you'll see that Erikson's 8 stages set up as a set of steps, and in between stages four and five, getting in the way of progress to stage five is a red circle. And in that circle, I put the words emerging adulthood. This is a term that was coined by another psychologist named Jeffrey Arnett, but he was building on Erikson's idea, and Erikson called this a moratorium stage. This is a break. It's a pause in psychosocial development. He said that people were getting stuck. And why were they getting stuck? Erikson said that they were getting stuck choosing a career. He said that as technology grows more complex, and not just technology, but the ideas of society, as these have become more complex and changed at a faster and faster pace, it has become harder and harder for young adults to target a career or a career identity. And more technology means that you need more education, and as they're getting that education, they're delaying their career targeting, which means that they're delaying their identity formation. Here's another really important thing Erikson said. Erikson said that an identity is formed when you negotiate a role in a community. This is such an important idea. I'll say this one more time. Erikson said that an identity is formed when you negotiate a role in a community. Negotiating a role, a real role, in a community will also mean that you are making a commitment to that community. Now, you could do this in a workplace, when, for example, you negotiate a role as an engineer. But we also do this in religious communities, right? You need a religious community to negotiate a role in, that is, to form an identity with. Now, a number of our ministry experts, when we talk to them, they observe that once people put some of their identity planks in place, they seem to put them all in place and in short order. It's like that there's one decision that they make, one facet of their identity, and once they put that stake in the ground, it allows them to go on and to round out the whole of their identity. And so there's a timing issue here. Is there a church or a Christian community that is part of their lives when their commitments start to be made? Because if there isn't, that community space, that identity space, will be filled by another community. And so our task is to make sure that there is a Christian community present when they start to make those commitments, when they start to put the pieces of their adult identity in place. Now, a religious commitment could come first, but we have done something in our culture where we have made career the preeminent choice. And it became very clear to us in our interviews that this even happens in the church, where every other facet of your life is on hold until you get that education that gets you that career. Let's just recap before we move on. Moving into adulthood means that you have attained the capacity to make adult commitments. Identity is about negotiating roles in communities. It's about committing to communities. It's about taking responsibility within and for these communities. And adulthood is now delayed. Statistics Canada measures entry into adulthood in five ways: age at first marriage, leaving school, leaving home, family formation, and entry into full-time work. The age at first marriage in Canada is delayed from about 23 years of age in 1971 till about 30 years of age, and this was in 2008 when Statistics Canada stopped reporting on this data. And by the way, it's not the case that young adults have simply decided that they're not going to get married now and they're living common law. The rates of both people being married and living common law has been in decline for years now. In 1986, only 15% of 25 to 34-year-olds had a university degree. By 2016, it was 35%. And if we add in the percent that are getting other kinds of degrees, we're up to 70% getting some kind of university, college, or post-secondary degrees. That is a big change in one generation. The average age at first birth for Canadian women has risen from 23 and a half years of age in the mid-1960s to 28 and a half in 2011. This is just for women who gave birth. It's not a general measure of fertility. In 1981, 42% of 20 to 24-year-olds lived at home. Now it's 63%. And housing prices have a lot to do with that. For 25 to 29-year-olds, the second half of that 20s decade, in 1981, 11% lived at home with their parents. Now 29% do. Full-time work is often difficult to get, and once you get it, it is less secure. Any way that you look at it, using StatsCan's measures of entry into adulthood, adulthood is delayed by about 5 to 7 years over what it was just a few decades ago. So moving into adulthood is a capacity issue as much as it is an issue of the will. Young adults lack the education to participate in the workforce. Young adults lack the capacity to do simple things like move out and pay for their own place. Now let's talk about differentiation. These adulthood markers are also what we call differentiation markers. Differentiation is the normal and healthy process of setting out identity markers between you and your family of origin. So it could be like this: this is my place, that's my parents' place. This is my job, and my job allows me to be something other than just my parents' child. I'm married now, and this is my family, that was my parents' family. I'm a father now and not just a son. You see, you need to be able to differentiate yourself from your family of origin if you're to be your own person. That is, if you're to form an adult identity. Now, we've been saying that the young adults don't have the same capacity to achieve those differentiation markers. And just because they don't have that capacity doesn't mean that they still don't have the need to become their own person. And what we realized is that some young adults, especially where their parents are devout, some young adults, in the absence of the capacity to differentiate themselves from their parents in other normal and healthy ways, were differentiating themselves from their parents by rejecting their parents' religion. So my parents are Baptist, or my parents are Christian Reformed. My parents' religious faith is a very deep and important part of who they are. Now, this is perfect, because this is how I can make a clear distinction between myself and them, and what is more and significant is it's within my capacity to do so. You see, emerging adulthood changes the differentiation options that are available to young adults, and this is a big deal for faith formation. Young adults, however, as a group, young adults are conflict-averse. When they reject their parents' faith, they generally don't go looking for a big fight about religion. Earlier generations might have done that. Rather, they look for opportunities to withdraw quietly. I have a part-time job now and I work on Sundays, so I withdraw. I'm on a sports team that travels to tournaments on the weekend, so I withdraw. I'm at university now and I'm pretty busy, so I withdraw. You said going to church was my decision now. Well, I'm not going to go. You see, even to tell your parents, I'm not going to go to church, is not as bold and in your face a rejection of religion as I don't agree with you and I'm leaving the Christian faith. Let's recap before we move on. Young adults lack the capacity for traditional differentiation markers. Some differentiate by rejecting their parents' religion, but they tend to find occasions and non-confrontational ways to do it. Differentiation is a necessary precursor to adult identity formation, and if a young adult differentiates by rejecting their parents' religion, then Christianity is off the table for when a young adult gains the capacity to make adult commitments, to negotiate adult roles, and to form an adult identity. So here's what we want to do. We want to do what we can to help young adults to have the capacity to negotiate adult roles while Christian communities are present. How are we going to do this? Well, we're going to look at the roles of mentors, youth groups, and Christian camps to start. And then what we're going to do also is we're going to look at their next Christian communities. And what do I mean by next Christian communities? These are the communities that they will have after they leave their home churches. It's the Christian campus groups. It's the next churches. And we live in a mobile society. And so chances are they're going to have a next Christian community if they have one at all. Let me start by telling you a story from our research about a young woman I'm going to call Joanna. Joanna grew up in a loving, devout Christian family. This was an in-the-doors, whenever the church was open kind of family. She did not describe her childhood, either in her home or in the church, as unpleasant. She attended a Christian school, had good relationships with her parents. She eventually did leave her childhood church, though. And you can read more about her story in the report. But what she really didn't like, and this is in her own words, is that she was always her last name, never her first. She was always Hank's daughter. She was never a member of the church, the adult church, the society of adults in that church, in her own right. She never had an adult role. You see, we love our kids, and most of our churches are doing really good children's ministry. Those kids, however, have to renegotiate their childhood roles, because if they're in our churches and they're 19, and they still have the same roles in our churches that they did when they were 11, then they're probably gone. Mentors, youth groups, and Christian camps all help young adults to renegotiate their roles in the church. And we'll talk more about mentors in a minute, but I want to say a few things about youth groups and Christian camps. First, youth groups and Christian camps are alongside the church. They are part of the church, but they are generally places where my parents are not. They are generally places that I have chosen to be at. They are generally places where I find my place, and they are generally places where I negotiate my own roles. And this is enormously important. If I have a role in the church through the youth group or through a Christian camp, if I have a Christian identity through the youth group or the Christian camp, then that's part of my identity that I worked out for myself. This wasn't just mom and dad dragging me to church and sitting me down on the pew beside them. It's my thing, not mom and dad's thing. Think of it like this. My kids could go camping. And when they go camping, they need a sleeping bag. And I can come along as dad and I can say, you're going camping. Here's a sleeping bag. It's mine. Take it. And they say, no, I want my own. And so they go down the street to the Canadian Tire and they look at all the sleeping bags on the shelf and they pull one down and it's the same one that I just offered them, but it's different, isn't it? It's their own. They chose it. Our youth groups are doing so much that is right, except when they stop. I want to talk about continuity. If you read youth ministry gurus like Powell and Clark and others, right now they'll all be down on programmatic ministry. And there's lots to say about this, but I want to focus on the fact that our youth ministry stops. Our kids age out. You make youth group a great place to be, and then you say, well, you can't be here anymore. And they say, well, yes, but that's my connection into the church. You say, I'm sorry, you're too old. And they say, but I don't belong with the adults, and you don't have a college and career group, and I don't have anything in common with those people anyway. You say, I'm sorry, you're out of high school. You're done. And they say, okay, bye then. You see, we've done something in our churches where we almost ritualistically take the only connection that they have ever negotiated with our church on their own, and at the end of high school, we kick them to the curb, and we say, now fight your way back into our community. So what is their way back in? What's their way back into the larger church? Youth group is good, and it's so good that we're doing it. But eventually what we want is for the young adults to take their place in the church, in the society of adults. Because let's be honest, that is what's waiting for them after youth group. It's the society of adults. And let's own this reality. The groups, really tight, good Christian community, tends to naturally resist new members, because if you've got a good thing going on, and you bring someone else into that good thing, they could disrupt it all. So it's easier to keep new people on the outside. So how do young adults break into the society of adults, which is often a different thing in our churches? I want to talk about mentors. There are all kinds of different ideas about what mentors are and what they do, and there's a general agreement that they're older, they're more mature, and that they help young adults as they mature. We're going to concentrate on four things, and this is not meant to be the last word on mentoring. What I am doing is I'm taking the framework of Eric Erickson's theory of psychosocial development. I'm taking seriously the idea that identity formation is about negotiating a role in a community, and I'm saying that there are four things here that mentors are. Mentors call out what God has placed inside. Mentors are reintroducers. Mentors are negotiation advisors. And mentors are continuity. We're going to talk briefly about each of these. The first point, mentors call out what is inside. When we talked to young adults in our interviews, there was this really weird way that they talked about their future. They would say things like, I don't know what I want to be, or I don't know what I want to do, or I don't know what I'm good at. Anybody here ever read Calvin and Hobbes? All right, I love Calvin and Hobbes. There's this sequence of cartoons in Calvin and Hobbes where Calvin has a time machine, and his present self goes to the future and gets his future self, and he brings his future self back to the present, and they get into all kinds of trouble, right? And so when young adults say something like, I don't know what I want to be, perhaps what they're saying is that my present self doesn't know what my future self is going to know about what I want. But I don't really think that that's what's going on. If we use Erickson and the idea that identity is about negotiating roles in communities, what I think that they're probably saying is, even though I have a pretty good idea of what I'm good at, I don't know where I'm going to be able to successfully negotiate a role with those skills or giftings. And if I can't do it in your community, then it's no good to me, so I'm going to discount that. Mentors help identify what young adults are good at. They come alongside and they say things like, God has given you this gifting. How might he be calling you to use it, to serve him? This isn't just information. The significant part of this is that somebody else noticed. And that in of itself means that others in the church might notice that I have this gifting, and if enough people do, they might give me an opportunity to negotiate a role to use that gifting in their church. In our interviews, young adults would say something like, I didn't know what I was good at. And you know the way the conversations are, they meander here, they meander there, and then they come around back to the same place. So they would say, I didn't know what I was good at. And then later on they would say, and a teacher noticed that I was good at explaining things. And just like that, a new teacher was born. A new teacher was born. This leads to mentoring point number two. Mentors are reintroducers. Mentors reintroduce young adults to the adult Christian community. Do you remember I was telling the story about Joanna? Joanna was always her last name, her father's name, never her own. No one reintroduced her, and so she was always, role-wise, a little girl in that congregation. An introduction is so simple and so profound. The mentor reintroduces the young adult to the church community, and in doing so, reshapes how they understand that person. Have you noticed that Joanna has a talent for? My, Joanna has really shown leadership in. I think we should be thinking about Joanna for that. Let's see what Joanna thinks about this. She has a really good eye for. You see, an introduction creates a space at the negotiating table. The mentor is an adult insider who creates the way in. The mentor throws the weight of his standing in the adult community behind the young adult. The mentor creates the opportunity for a successful negotiation of an adult role in the church community. So mentors call out giftings, mentors reintroduce, and mentors are negotiation advisors. This is our third point. On a certain level, young adults have to do their own negotiating. Mentors can help secure a seat at the negotiating table. They can help establish the opening bargaining position through the reintroduction. But at some point, young adults have to get in there and do their own bargaining. And anybody who's been in church for any length of time knows that that doesn't always go well. Anybody ever had a bad experience in church? Mentors come alongside young adults. They help them to process what happened. They help them to understand what God might be doing in the life of the church, in their lives, in the lives of the person that may have hurt them. They help them to see the larger picture of the kingdom of God, to get back in there and to continue to negotiate. It's a lot of conversation. It's a lot of walking with, but it is part of what mentors do. We had 4 points: calling, reintroducing, supporting, and now continuity. And this continuity piece is going to lead us into our next section. The programs in our churches start and stop, start and stop, start and stop. And if your programs are the relational glue that binds young adults to your church, then every time a program stops, you are breaking the relationship of that young adult with your church. What the relationship of mentors do is they come in behind your programs and they backstop all of the starting and stopping of those programs, which are good. Don't get me wrong, the programs are good. But they cannot be the relational glue into your church. Now, some of you have probably been longing for a few stats. So here's some stats. 43% of young adults told us that they had a home church mentor whom they looked up to in high school. That's good news. Of this 43%, 61% said they are still in regular contact with their home church mentor. Now, we had different measures of religious persistence in our survey, such as religious service attendance or whether young adults who went on to post-secondary education connected with a Christian campus group. And so we're going to look at the stats for connecting with a Christian campus group. In this slide, we asked whether they connected with a Christian campus group. And what we found was that if you had a home church mentor and you're still in regular contact with that home church mentor, 57% of them went on to connect with a Christian campus group. If you had a home church mentor but you're no longer in contact with that home church mentor, then only 35% of those went on to connect with a Christian campus group. If you did not have a home church mentor, only 13% of those young adults went on to connect with a Christian campus group. By the way, we only asked this question of those that went on to post-secondary education. Clearly, there is a correlation both with having a home church mentor and having a mentor continue to be involved in a young adult's life and whether they continue on being present in the next Christian community. Now, when we talked with ministry workers, though, about mentoring, they told us that mentoring is intimidating for prospective mentors. 59% of ministry workers said they have a hard time finding mentors. 55% agreed that they have difficulty finding the time to mentor those who are referred to them personally. Now, we talked about the role of the mentor in making reintroductions into the church community. Now I want to look at the power of making simple, thoughtful introductions. If you ask someone why they didn't go to a church, anyone of any age, why they didn't come in here to Willoughby CRC, they'll probably say something like, "I'm not going in there because I don't know anyone." You see, there are a few intrepid extroverts that will wade into any crowd and they'll make friends, but for most of us, we're a little bit shy about moving into a group where we don't know anybody. And so we asked ministry experts, who was responsible for making connections for young adults either to a Christian campus group or to a new church? And 80% of them said the young adults themselves have the responsibility to make those connections. Now, they said that that was shared with other people, but think about this. 80% of ministry workers said that the young adults themselves have the responsibility for making the connections. How many of you, when you don't know anybody, will charge into a new group and make your own connections? Well, we surveyed young adults, and about four times as many young adults connected with a Christian campus group when someone from their home church tried to make a connection for them than when no one did. Where someone from their home church tried to make a simple, thoughtful connection with someone in a Christian campus group, 66% went on to connect with that campus group versus 16% when no one from their home church did this. Now, there's likely a whole lot more going on in the background. You are probably better integrated into your home church if there is someone making a connection for you with a Christian campus group. But it begs the question, what kinds of churches go out of their way to help young adults make that first and significant connection with that Christian campus group when they go off to start college or university? But wow, what a huge difference it makes. And by the way, when a local church tried to make a connection to a Christian campus group and the young adult had a home church mentor and the mentor was continued to be involved in their lives, 79% of those young adults connected with a Christian campus group. So an introduction is key. Let's talk about timing. Again, these numbers are really similar for whether we're talking about connecting with a Christian campus group or connecting with another local church. So we're going to continue to talk about connections with a Christian campus group. We asked those who connected to a Christian campus group how soon it was after they started college or university before they connected with a Christian campus group. And this is what they told us. So if you look at the pie chart behind me, the dark blue here, that's 37%. They made the connection within the first 2 weeks. The light blue was the percent that made the connections in weeks 3 and 4. I want you to think about that. Your young adults go off to university. They're not in your church. They're in another city. The candidate Christian communities are a new church or a Christian campus group. And 3/4 of those that will ever connect with a Christian campus group do it within the first 4 weeks. By the way, the numbers are very similar for connecting with a local church. That first month is critical. Think about your own experience. Hands up if the people that you met or hung out with all the way through university, you met in the first month, for those who went. For me, the friends I met during Frosh Week at the University of Waterloo, I just happened to stumble upon an InterVarsity Christian Fellowship booth, and those friends, they changed my life. 4 weeks. That's something really practical to work with. Let's recap before we move on. Identity formation happens when you negotiate a role in a community. Identity formation is now delayed. We need Christian communities to be present in young adults' lives when they are gaining the capacity to make commitments. We need candidate Christian communities and young adults for them to negotiate roles in. Mentors, consistent mentors, are part of the solution, and so are simple, thoughtful connections made to next Christian communities. Emerging adulthood delays decisions in part because young adults lack the capacity to make commitments. And now we're going to look at why young adults might want to stay emerging adults. And in the process, we're going to talk about how they're seeing religion. So we're going to start by talking about a triad of fears, right? We have FOMO, this is the fear of missing out. FNBA, that's not the fear of basketball, that's the fear of not being amazing. And FOPM, the fear of passionless monotony. Let's start with FOMO. This is probably the one that you're most familiar with. And this is applications in different applications in different contexts. It is the fear that something better will come along and you'll miss out if you commit too early. Right? This is why young adults don't commit to an event until the last minute, because they're on social media saying, is there something better going on tonight? Right? This is also why when we talk to young adults about their decision-making for the future, a lot of them actually aren't targeting those careers right out of high school. What they're doing is they're picking a university program or a college program, and the quote, what they're looking for in that university or college program, most of all, is that it gives them the opportunity to pivot one way or the other. Is it a kind of a generalist thing that allows me to make a decision at the last minute for another career, right? Because they don't want to commit too early to a particular program and miss out. It may also be why they're delaying marriage, right? Because they're walking around saying, God, just let there be one more person out there than what's on offer right now, right? Fear of missing out. FNBA, that's the fear of not being amazing. Several ministry experts told us about talented, gifted young adults who would start something and then pull out at the last minute if it looked like they weren't going to nail it. If it looked like they weren't going to be amazing. And I believe they said this was especially true for young men. Finally, there is FOPM, the fear of passionless monotony. This is the fear that your job or your life post-university or post-high school will be boring, dull, or socially isolating. One expert in the literature talked about something called a quarter-life crisis, not a midlife crisis, a quarter-life crisis. This is what happens when you finish university, you're 1 year into your first job, and you quit because it wasn't supposed to be like this. FOPM is the fear of passionless monotony. And if you think about FOMO and FMBA and FOPM, they're all looking forward to adulthood, that time when the commitments are made and there's no going back. And they're looking forward with a kind of dread. And there's this really interesting way that almost all of the young adults we talked to talked about adulthood. They called it the real world. The real world. And the real world is not a good thing, in case you're wondering. And it kind of goes like this when we're contrasting the real world with emerging adulthood. In emerging adulthood, people are young, beautiful, and healthy. Creating is relatively easy. I have all the technology, I can do this online. I am in control of my life. You may not feel like it, but your schedules are largely in your control. You're in a socially rich environment, often because many of them are in school and all their friends are there, and there's lots of activities being planned for them, a rich variety of activities. Networking is easy. Make my friends on social media and connect with my friends. And groups are customized to me. And in a place like social media, if someone in the group isn't customized to you, it's really easy. You can just click them away, unfriend them, and they need never know that you did it. Now, in adulthood, in the real world, people are older, less beautiful, and less healthy. Creating becomes hard. Others are in control, usually your boss. You're in a socially isolating environment, possibly because you're at work and you see those same four people every day, and at least two of them you just can't stand. You're doing dull or repetitive activities. Comes in every job. And networking is hard because people are fallen. And you have to fit in with groups as they present themselves, not as you design them. And by the way, church is one of those groups, where you just have to fit in with the people that are there, because you can't go into church and click the unlovely people away. They stay there. So if I'm here in emerging adulthood, and what's waiting for me is the real world, why would I ever want to leave? See, a stay in emerging adulthood, I've been belaboring this idea that it is a capacity issue. And it is in part. But it's also about avoiding the real world. Consider the life trajectory that we used to work with. We used to say something like this. We're born into this world of toil and trouble, the result of the fall, but God, through Jesus Christ, saves us from sin, redeeming the world in an act of salvation that culminates in heaven, and I call this one bad to good. With emerging adulthood, though, you start out healthy, beautiful, and in control, in a socially rich environment, and then you fall into the real world. It's the opposite trajectory. And I call this one good to bad. See, some cultures and times are more hospitable to one heresy or another. For those of you who have been to seminary and thought about heresies, they always come back again. And in our culture, is very hospitable to something called Gnosticism. And for Gnosticism, it associated the physical world with evil. Now, in emerging adulthood, and in our culture generally, this isn't just emerging adults, but emerging adulthood presents as spiritual, read non-physical, both in the presence and the importance of social media, which we now call digital instead of spiritual. But what digital and spiritual share is that they're both immaterial. They're not hard stuff, right? And so digital is the new spiritual. And so you have the digital, spiritual, easy, beautiful, new versus the physical, slow, hard, real world, old. And this is fertile ground for Gnosticism. Now, many of you who are in youth ministry will be familiar with Christian Smith's moralistic therapeutic deism, and I've reproduced his definition on the slide behind me. We'll go over this in a minute, but I want to say that when Christian Smith is an American psychologist, he came up with this in 2005 in a book called Soul Searching. I mention the date because I want to sort of anchor that in that time period and say that from 2005 to 2019, a little bit of time has gone by. What Christian Smith said was, for moralistic therapeutic deism, he said this was the dominant religion in America today, and it goes like this. A God exists who created and orders the world and watches over human life on earth. God wants people to be good, nice, and fair to each other, as taught in the Bible and by most world religions. The central goal of life is to be happy and to feel good about oneself. God does not need to be particularly involved in one's life except when needed to resolve a problem, and good people go to heaven when they die. When I was reading about this, what I found really interesting is that Christian Smith said that those who hold to moralistic therapeutic deism experience religion as homogenizing, not polarizing. I thought this was really interesting because when I grew up, there were two things that you didn't talk about in polite company. One was politics and the other was religion. How is it that you have people now experiencing religion as homogenizing, that is bringing people together, and not polarizing, that is pushing them apart? Well, in our interviews, we found a variation on Christian Smith's moralistic therapeutic deism. It's the same in that it's experienced as homogenizing, not polarizing. It's the same in that it has a fairly basic morality based on niceness. It's different in that God is not necessary, nor is a notion of heaven or hell. And we call this the universal Gnostic religious ethic, and it goes like this. All religions are the same if you can get behind their external trappings. This realization is understood as a special knowledge for the enlightened. Religion is functional. It fulfills a set of psychosocial functions. The most important thing is to preserve social harmony. Good human beings preserve social harmony. And a higher power is not necessary, nor is a notion of heaven or hell. Let me draw some connections for you with this idea of Gnosticism. I'm going to give you sort of a 2 or 3 minute high-level version of Gnosticism. Gnosticism was an early heresy that the church has always been wrestling with. It went like this. They had their idea of God that they called sort of the first father or the first mover, okay? And that this first mover would emanate a pantheon of gods. Think like Marvel comic book heroes, right? A whole pantheon of gods. And that they're all connected back up into the first father, but they lived in a spiritual world that had no physical existence. And then sin came into the world when one of these gods that emanated from the first father sins against the first father. And the consequence of that is that that the reality that they had, it was like their version of heaven called the Pleroma, frayed around the edges, and what it frayed into was the physical world. And so the physical world comes about, it is a manifestation of sin. And so the goal of life for the Gnostic is to escape the physical world, going up through the different levels of heaven. You've heard about the seventh heaven. This comes from this very old idea that there are levels to heaven and that the spiritual climbing is to climb the different levels. So the goal of the Gnostic is to escape the physical world and climb back into the heaven to connect back with the first father. How do you do this? Well, Gnostics get their name from a Greek word gnosis, meaning knowledge. In the ancient Gnostics, they would look for a special knowledge that would allow them to do this, a special knowledge of the secrets. And often these secrets came to them in a moment of sudden enlightenment. And with this special knowledge then, they would use this and it would free them from the restrictions of the physical world. Now, in our case, where we start to make some of these connections is the physical world, for us, is the real world. So for the ancient Gnostics, that special knowledge was magic. Right? They would learn special charms, numbers, and names. And with this special knowledge, they could control the material world through immaterial spells, right? Words don't have substance. They're just out there. And when they cast these spells and they controlled the physical world through it, what they were demonstrating is that they weren't subject to the limitations of the physical world in the same way as those without the special knowledge. Right? So you have the immaterial world controlling and the physical world and freeing people from the limitations of the physical world through those spells. Now, what I said is that today, our digital world is immaterial. What characterizes our digital world is the ability to transcend the limitations of the physical world in time and space with things like this. So, for instance, with these phones, right, when they introduce a new phone, they're always selling it to you because it's going to reduce the inconvenience of time and space. And so as an ultimate goal of what these phones will develop into is something that will help you transcend time and space. And this is where we change ourselves. We have pictures that look better than the way we really look, and we post those. Most of those who hold to the universal Gnostic religious ethic will talk about a moment when they realize that the differences between religions were only apparent. This is a moment of sudden enlightenment. This is one of the ways in which the universal Gnostic religious ethic is Gnostic. Churches and religious communities exist in the real world, and they place restrictions on what you can do and what you can't do. But when you have this enlightenment that behind all religions they're the same, then you are not bound in the same way by a particular religion. You transcend it. And one of the ways that young adults feel bound by religion is in its exclusive claims that brings them into conflict with their friends. I want you to see that the potential conflict is a limitation that they want to transcend. And the special knowledge of the universal Gnostic religious ethic, it can create intimacy. If your religious differences don't matter, then you can quickly connect with someone from another religion on the level that really matters by agreeing that what separates you religiously doesn't matter. That religious tension then is gone if we all agree that it doesn't matter. And this knowledge then creates a community of those who understand this. So the universal Gnostic religious ethic is a strategy for dealing with religious difference. And young adults deal with far more religious difference than many of us who are older ever did. How many of our young adults, or older adults for that matter, could give an account of the Christian faith and say, here's my argument for why I believe and why I'm a Christian? That's what we used to have to deal with. And maybe if we were trying to distinguish ourselves from Catholics, we could argue about why we weren't Catholic or something like that. In today's world, they're dealing with people who are Sikh, Buddhist, Hindu, Muslim. How many of our young adults can compare and contrast what all of these different world religions believe along with Christianity and then come to a conclusion and say, and this is why I choose to be a Christian? You see, it's much harder to do that. And it's far easier to use Uyghur as a fallback position and to say none of this really matters. See, the purpose of Uyghur is to help people to become good human beings. And if you ask young adults what a good human being is, it will be some variation on someone who promotes social harmony. And so religion, or Uyghur, then is functional. It doesn't save you or bring you into a relationship with God. Rather, it helps to promote the psychosocial goal of social harmony. Therefore, God is not strictly necessary if you can get there without God. And this means that young adults, and remember we're talking about young adults raised in the church, they generally don't actually talk about Jesus or even God, but a higher power. And when you ask them about the higher power, it doesn't intervene in their lives or require anything of them, but they hope it might possibly intervene positively on their behalf should they find themselves in trouble, but they don't really know why it would. And this has consequences for us coming from one of those particular real-world traditions. Because commitment, and that's a word that gets grouped in with adulthood, remember. Commitment is a bad thing because commitments to a doctrine, to a religion, to a tradition, calls into question the ways in which all religions, if you get behind them, are the same. This has a consequence for differentiation as well. We talked about how some young adults use religion as a way to differentiate themselves from their parents, and this is often how they're doing it. You know, my parents don't understand this, but I do. Therefore, I'm part of this new group that has received this special knowledge. Remember, even when young adults reject their parents' religion, they don't tend to have a conflict about it. This is likely because they've concluded that those differences don't matter. So why would I get into a big conflict with my parents about something that ultimately doesn't matter? And Uyghur fits, or the Universal Gnostic Religious Ethic fits with emerging adulthood in that it does not ask for commitments, rather it says the commitments are problematic. I'm just going to recap and then we'll finish up. Identity is formed when you negotiate a role in a community. Adult identity formation is delayed, moving it for most people into their 20s when they have left their home church communities. Delayed adulthood means delayed differentiation, making religion an attractive differentiation marker. Mentors, youth groups, and Christian camps all help young adults negotiate identities within the church apart from the direction of their parents. Mentors, especially, are critical points of continuity, introducing and helping facilitate role development within the church. Connections to next Christian communities are vital for young adults, and these communities themselves are often the Christian communities that young adults will negotiate a Christian identity in when they gain the capacity to make adult commitments. The trajectory of religious experience has been reversed, providing a fertile ground for a new universal Gnostic religious ethic. This is some of what we've come across to try to hit on the high points. And this is where you can find the report if you're interested. It's a free download, and that's my contact information. Thank you.